beloved listeners, as you know, this little wireless program is officially called Late Night Live, but tonight it's Late Night Lonely, because that's the topic of our discussion on this public holiday, loneliness. Everyone experiences loneliness at some stage, the feeling of being abandoned, possibly hurt, and certainly alone. And we're so hardwired for human connection that prolonged and serious isolation can demonstrably destroy health, mental and physical. Now, while many people are living alone these days, the aged rarely or less often live with their families and offspring, and the issue of loneliness in Western society is of growing fascination and concern. What impact has so-called social media, so often antisocial media, had on the phenomenon of loneliness and alienation, particularly amongst the young, is something that I want to discuss. And I am not alone in the studio. I'm connected to fascinating people across the planet. John T. Cacioppo is considered an expert on loneliness. John's the director for the Center for Cognitive and Social Neuroscience at the University of Chicago and co-author of Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. And John joins me now from Chicago, where it is 5:30 a.m. Social commentator Stephanie Darrick, author of numerous books, including Intimacy and Solitude, Balancing Closeness and Independence. And Stephanie joins me from our Brisbane studio. Emily White quit her job as a lawyer and since devoted her life to the full-time study of loneliness. And her memoir is called Lonely, and she joins me from Toronto. Welcome to our little wireless program. John, can you get us off to a flying start by giving us a working definition of loneliness?
Loneliness is typically defined as a discrepancy between the desired social relations and those that are manifest. So if you wish to have a particular kind of relationship, perhaps with your spouse, and it's falling short, that leaves you feeling isolated.
John, we're being somewhat isolated by a very poor connection. So while we try and get a better line to you, I'm going to talk to my fellow Australian, Stephanie. Stephanie, you make the interesting point that it takes just a tiny little hiccup to make us feel lonely. A simple thing like a busy day at the office and then walking into an empty house can trigger off loneliness.
Well, that's very much to do with your expectation as you move into the house, or what you would ideally like to have in your house. You know, I was interested in John's definition, but I would see it very slightly differently. I see loneliness as a spectrum of experiences that takes in lots of emotions. And at one end, there's even a quite cozy version of it, which is, you know, you're basically living in fairly loving and satisfying connections with other people, but you're away for some days and you feel a little bit lonely. But there's a kind of coziness to that because you will return. And at the quite the other end of the spectrum, of course, there's the feeling that you will never really connect with another person and that you're pretty disconnected from yourself. You're pretty disconnected from your hopes for something better. And, of course, at that point, loneliness tips into despair. So it's a whole range of experiences.
As you were talking about the brief feeling of loneliness when you're apart, I suddenly remember that strange emotion you get in hotel rooms and the anonymity of hotel rooms.
Yeah.
But Stephanie, there's a paradox. I've flown halfway around the world sitting side by side with someone and we haven't exchanged a word. On have gone the headphones. You know, this is not uncommon. People seeking to create an apartness.
Yes, but you see, each person would experience that very differently. For many people, it might be a relief from a life in which there's almost too much interaction. And for somebody else, it's a reinforcement that nobody wants to talk to them. So how we would judge a situation from the outside would be very flimsy, according to the way that the person might be experiencing it on the inside, which is actually one of the reasons why it's so wonderful that you're talking about this now, because many people have very little conception how other people experience loneliness, and there's quite a lot of shame attached to it. You know, we all think we ought to be tremendously popular people and that our company should be desired and wanted and sought at all times. And if we have even a glimmering that perhaps that's not the case, or that the person that we most wanted to be with is no longer with us, you know, perhaps they've died, perhaps they've left us, and, you know, all sorts of circumstances arise there too. And in that, we sometimes feel shame about the loneliness, as though it's something that we should keep hidden in case, you know, other people catch it.
Stephanie, there are many people who enjoy being alone. I count myself amongst them. I have
yes.
a huge amount of human interaction in my little lonely monk cell here.
Yes.
And so then I head off to the bush and I spend a huge amount of time mm-hmm. on my own. Mm-hmm. And people like us, who are not particularly gregarious, are sometimes mm-hmm. called loners, but loners aren't lonely.
And I'm not sure that loner is quite the right word for it. I think actually it's somebody who can enjoy their own company, but also, and this is so significant, Philip, your needs are getting met for company. If the need you have for company was not met and it was only aloneness, you would experience that aloneness very differently. And of course, that's one of the things that I write most about when I make the distinctions between solitude, which is a generally speaking, a fairly agreeable experience of being alone with yourself and feeling alive inside yourself and not focusing only on what you don't have, but rather on what you're enjoying. And that's a very different thing from that feeling of loneliness, aloneness, exile almost from the human experiences that you most want.
Late Night Lonely on Radio National, and my guests on a discussion about loneliness, Stephanie Darrick and Emily White. And I'm afraid we've lost Professor John because that connection to Chicago, which wasn't up to scratch, cannot be improved. Emily, you were a lawyer, you had a supportive family, you had good friends. Where and when did your loneliness arrive?
I'd say my loneliness, first of all, I'd say for many people, loneliness can be on and off a lifelong condition, and I had been having problems with it for quite a long time, despite the fact that I actually had a big circle of friends, and I'm, you know, met most of the standards for what we call popularity. So it was sort of lurking in the background my whole life, and then when I was 31, I'm in my mid-40s now, a whole series of things happened. Namely, my father died rather suddenly. And that set just a cascading series of emotions into effect. My father died, and I began work as a lawyer, and I was in a very specialized field, which meant I was isolated, and I'd lost touch with my classmates who'd gone to the big litigation firms in Toronto. And I just started to feel increasingly alone, and what had been a kind of a temporary or sporadic problem in the past became a chronic problem, in that loneliness really began to take over my life. It became sort of the dominating emotion that I woke up to every morning and had to deal with all day and then went to bed with at night. And that's a very, very, very hard situation to find yourself in, because especially if everything in your life looks all right, like you've got the good job and the nice apartment and you do have friends and you do have social support, it can become very, very hard to not start blaming yourself for what you're going through. And once you start blaming yourself for your own emotions, you're stuffed, right? It's just downhill from there. And so my loneliness lasted, I'd say, at least 4 years. And I don't think we recognize generally how grueling an experience that can be for people, because people don't talk about it.
Emily, when did you first seek therapy?
Therapy for loneliness?
Yeah.
Probably when I always say the one good thing about me getting chronically lonely is I was also working as a lawyer, so I had a lot of money to throw at solutions. And I started seeing a therapist probably around when I was 32, so while I had been in this state of loneliness for at least a year. And I found that helped, because it didn't solve the loneliness, but there was at least one person in my life who I could be honest with about it and could have someone else see it when I was hiding it really, really, really proactively from everyone else. I could at least, you know, there was an hour a week where I could walk into my therapist's office and say, this is a problem. And she didn't end the loneliness, but at least she gave me a reprieve from the sense of having to hide it.
Stephanie, you write that when loneliness takes up lodgings, it's always worth seeking help. You may be lonelier than you need to be because you're also depressed. And I want to explore this, the subtleties, the differences between feeling lonely and being depressed.
Did you want Emily to comment on that?
No, that's to you, Steph.
All right, okay. Look, I think there's a lot of crossover and that, you know, the very same person in some moments would describe their state of feeling. It's not just a state of mind, their state of feeling, you know, in one way or another, lonely, not understood, or, you know, or depressed. Look, it's so interesting to hear what Emily has to say about the anguish when appearances would suggest that you're living one kind of life, but your inner experience tells you something different. And I think that when any kind of therapeutic help comes that's worthwhile, it will somehow bring those realities together so that, for example, we can not only trust other people that they can glimpse that inner reality, but we can also look at that inner reality with less sense of powerlessness and with a great deal more compassion. Now, when I was preparing to speak with you this evening, I had a look at Intimacy and Solitude, which I revised in 2002. So it was some time since I've looked at it, even though a new edition has just come out. And I found a sentence which I was really struck by, and it may resonate with Emily, and I'll just read it to you, one short sentence. I said of myself, being alone was the only way I could survive my profound feelings of aloneness. And when I read that sentence, I got a shock because I'm a long way from that place. But then I immediately remembered, and I remembered in my body, you know, which is where we store our emotions, that I had to kind of gather myself in times of aloneness. I couldn't gather myself sufficiently in the company of other people in order to present to the world a highly competent, you know, funny, interactive kind of a person. And I certainly see that all the therapy that I did and all the therapy that I was able to give to other people during the years I was in practice and all the work that I did in writing Intimacy and Solitude, which took 6 years, I somehow healed that gap. But it was a big healing, and what it really meant, and I'd be so interested to have Emily's comments on this too, what it really meant was healing the way I saw myself inside out, and also dealt with myself, talked to myself, supported myself, so that rather than blame and shame, I could begin to feel some compassion for how this had come about, and also to feel some hope that that I could be calmer on the inside and actually really enjoy those times of solitude, which I was also doing.
Okay, let's go back to Toronto. Let's go back to Emily White for a response to what she's just heard you saying. Emily?
I would completely agree. I really like the statement that the only way, I was jotting it down, the only way you could handle loneliness was by being alone. I also experienced that very deeply. I think we forget how exhausting loneliness could be, and you need time to recover from it, and you need time to not hide, which creates this sort of perpetuating cycle of withdrawing into yourself in order to restore yourself. But you're doing that on your own. You're not interacting with people. And I think that was what I got caught in. And I do agree with all sorts of notions about changing the way you see yourself and changing the way you interact. I guess where I would differ is, how can I put this? I don't know that you can, and I'm not sure that this is being suggested, but I don't know that you can do that work on your own. I definitely changed a whole lot of things about the way I thought about myself, about the way I thought about others, but I did that within a relationship that was encouraging me to trust more, to reveal more, to not withdraw into myself. I mean, people kind of get frustrated when I say this, but I found a romantic relationship, and it was what I needed to change those behaviors. And I don't think the relationship had to be romantic. I think what the romance element did was introduce an element of surprise that wasn't there with my friends or my family. It was sort of a new role that I could take on. And I would also, you know, and I'd like to get, you know, feedback on this, but for me, the process of changing did take years. I mean, I think we have this idea that loneliness just ends, like you flip on a light switch and it's gone. But, and that might be true for some people, and I think it's probably definitely true for short-term loneliness, but I think for long-term loneliness, A, you need help getting over it, and B, it doesn't end right away.
Stephanie, there's some writing of Emily that I was reading today where she talks about there's no pill for loneliness, just as there's no pill for boredom, and I'm delighted to know that that's true, because if there's one thing that makes me queasy, it's the medicalization of human emotion.
Yes.
And, you know, a pill for grief, you know, it just, I just don't like it.
No.
And, but isn't there already, if insofar as loneliness is now overlapping with depression, isn't there already perhaps an attempt to medicalize loneliness?
Look, there probably is, and I think several things I want to say also in response to Emily, that it's so tremendously important that we begin to receive relationships a little bit differently, because what I was actually talking about in my earlier quote was a sense of aloneness or a sense of detachment, which isn't always the same thing as loneliness. It isn't always a longing for something that isn't there. That's a little bit of a difference. But the really important point is that we begin to take in experiences differently. We begin to experience our inner world differently. And usually that comes about either through a skillful therapeutic relationship or a relationship that is very enhancing in our outer life. But of course, the danger there is to think that the cure for loneliness is romantic love. And, you know, often people can throw themselves into a very idealized version of romantic love and then ask too much of it, because they're hoping that it will heal everything within them, rather than looking at, well, what's the history there of not taking in experiences that are deeply satisfying enough that they can sustain us through periods of delightful solitude or welcome solitude. I think that's a really, really important distinction. And just one tiny last point also is that a certain amount of loneliness can be usefully provocative. You know, we don't need to medicalize it. We don't need to take a pill, because a certain amount of loneliness can be a wake-up call. What am I needing more of in my life? What am I prepared to put myself outside my comfort zone to achieve? What am I ready to generate, not just to be saved from, but to generate from within? And, you know, so a certain amount of loneliness, just like a certain amount of boredom, can lead to a surge of creativity or action or social action, that it can be tremendously healthy.
Now, if John was still with us, I was going to get him to read from some of his research, and now I'm getting technical. When we drew blood from our older adults and analysed their white cells, we found that loneliness somehow penetrated the deeper recesses of the cell, the deepest recesses, to alter the way genes were being expressed. Loneliness affects not only the brain, but the basic process of DNA transcription. Mm-hmm. When you are lonely, your whole body is lonely. Lonely people tend to be more hostile, tend to eat foods that have higher contents of sugar and fat. Mm-hmm. The lonely have greater resistance to blood flow in their veins, which can lead to high blood pressure. On and on, this stuff of John's goes. And that's really quite astonishing. But it wouldn't surprise you, Emily.
No, it wouldn't. I think the notion of loneliness working its way right into us is intuitively sound, and it's very, very interesting and very important that John and his team and his collaborators have sorted out all the ways in which it works its way into us. I think lonely people, when they're lonely, don't think or possibly care about those very, very fine points of physiology, but I think they would agree wholeheartedly that loneliness works its way into your body, often because you just don't feel well. I was, by my fourth year of loneliness, things were going so haywire in my body that I was sent for an MRI scan because the suspicion was, I had all these strange symptoms, and the suspicion was that I was developing multiple sclerosis, which never really frightened me because I didn't think I was, and the MRI revealed that I wasn't. But it was kind of, and in Toronto, possibly also in Australia, you know, there's such a demand for MRIs that they run all night long. So I was at 4 o'clock in the morning alone in a downtown hospital, sitting in a hospital gown. And I thought, this is where I have landed. Like, this has become such an excruciating experience that I'm actually sort of entering the medical realm. And it was a very lonely moment. And I thought, this is how badly this is affecting me. I'm actually getting a medical test because things are going so wrong within me. And it feels like there's this unanswered need within you. And I guess John's science has supported that in a variety of fine ways. But you feel it kind of right in your bones. It's like, well, like, and your Australian audience might not relate to this, but it's like being very, very, very cold outside for a very, very long time and not being able to get home fast enough to warm up and being like that emotionally all the time. So my results were fine, and eventually I did get over the loneliness, but it certainly had a strong physical impact on
me. Stephanie?
Yeah, look, I'm just completely interested in what you're saying and the quotes also from John, because I think that people actually do know that at some level, and we certainly know that the opposite is true, or the other end of the spectrum is true, that when people have satisfying interpersonal relationships, that will determine their happiness, and the happiness they feel, of course, has a real effect on their physiology and their well-being and so on. Of course, other factors play a part too, but there is absolutely no doubt that we give ourselves the best chance of good health when our psyche is also in good shape. But what I was also thinking about when Emily was speaking was that the very big factor of letting people in. Now, so there are two things to think about here. One is that some people will feel agonizingly lonely because nobody wants to come in, as it were. Nobody cares. Everybody in the world is apparently indifferent to your fate. And there are people living like that. Or they care about you only in relation to your functions, you know, how well you perform your job, or, you know, how tidy you keep your house.
Emily, so, your research included contacting researchers from Arizona to Scotland, talking to people right across the US. Where did you find these researchers, and who were they?
John has kind of done a lot to bring this research out of the closet, so to speak. But I think we've got this notion that is changing. So, you know, I started the book in 2006, and back then there was no real notion, at least with it, I can't speak for Australia, but in North America, that loneliness was something you researched and studied and got grants for. And I became amazed that there was this whole school of research going on about loneliness, you know, about the interpersonal aspects, the physiological aspects, psychological changes. And it was just a matter of tracking these people down and asking them about their work and then sort of putting a picture together about loneliness. And I think the main thing to take away from that is not one specific point or one specific researcher, though there are some fantastic researchers out there. It's that loneliness is a real state that people in universities study. And we tend to, and that again undermines the notion of loneliness as a fleeting emotion. It's more like studying depression, though the research community is much smaller and there's not the same amount of money flowing into it. It's there. Though I would like to pick up on something Stephanie alluded to, which is, you know, this whole conversation is going on about, this point doesn't need to lead anywhere. I would just like to make it, you know, this whole conversation is going on about, well, I guess in my case, about someone who's got, you know, a social support network and a job. And I really had a great apartment. I always talk about the apartment at the time. But there are people who don't have those things, and yeah. I think we tend to overlook the people who are objectively isolated. And at least I have a voice, and Stephanie has a voice, and we can talk on the radio about our experiences, which are kind of middle class and in some ways softer. And I never want to lose sight of the people who are really alone, and no matter what they do, they can't. You know, they don't have the money to go out and have coffee with a
friend. Okay, so suddenly we've introduced class to the debate. We could also introduce gender. We could do, there's a lot of issues here, but I'd like at this point, though, to go off in a different direction, and that is to introduce or reintroduce the notion of social media. My observation, and it's a banal one, Stephanie, is that it creates the illusion of connectedness, but in some ways makes people feel more apart. Mind you, it's not the first time this has happened. The act of reading a book was a very isolating and very personal thing to do, and it often cuts you off from friends and family. How do you feel about the social media?
Look, I'm eager to speak to you about social media, Philip, but I think we just can't leave that point behind that Emily raised, because it's such a significant one, and you know it's not related only to social class. Social class is a factor, but it's not, I don't think it's even a key factor. And I come from a much more object relations psychoanalytic background, especially in thinking about this, you know, thinking about what were the very earliest experiences that a person had, and if there was wounding, how that's lived out. And of course, in a way, that's a very optimistic framework. I think so, because it also suggests that if you have healing relationships, some of that early wounding can be at least somewhat remedied. And those experiences cut across social class. But I think we also need to hold in mind that power is a very big factor here. So it's not just social class, it's power. And I think that's dramatically illustrated when we think that people in prisons who are receiving the worst punishments are put into solitary confinement. Or, you know, I mean, we think of that, we know that to be a kind of a drastic dehumanizing. But I think we also need to think about all the people in our world, for example, at this very moment, who are homeless, who are countryless, who are displaced. And there's a loneliness in that that I think is beyond our imagining if we are living in place, even if we don't always feel comfortable in it.
Well, I'm going to drag you back to social media. Surely all of these problems that you just whizzed through are ameliorated, miraculously fixed by social media. Come on, Stephanie.
Oh, Philip. Well, actually, I share tweet conversations with you sometimes. And, you know, sometimes when I look at the Twitter stream in the mornings, and I think, oh, it's so marvelous. You know, I can know what this person's thinking, and I can know what's obsessing that person. And, you know, if we had to rely on seeing each other, you know, every couple of years or something, we wouldn't know. And I find that very rich. And I think for social activists, and Emily, Philip is a social activist, and I'm a social activist, and perhaps you are too. I think for social activists, Twitter is an amazing forum. I use a Facebook that is, you know, in inverted commas, inspirational, because that's my field of writing. But I think there's a real problem with personal Facebook. I think there are tremendous advantages, but one of the disadvantages is that the narrative that most people present on Facebook is the, you know, happy, everything's going well, you know, having a wild time with this friend, you know, my baby's walked at 6 months and speaks French at 15 months. There's a lot of boasting and falseness that goes on. And if somebody is vulnerable to loneliness, this doesn't assuage it.
Emily?
Social media, I know you don't want to get back to the point that Steffi and I keep raising.
I'm happy to go back in due course, but for heaven's sake, you know.
I think social media... I'll
indulge me.
I think I have heard, after my book came out, I have heard from thousands of lonely people, and through email. So these are people using the internet. No one talks about social media in describing their struggles with loneliness. I think lonely people know they need something more than social media. You know, the questions I get are often more than social media. So it's people, I think lonely people recognize social media for what it is. And I completely agree with Stephanie's point about this, these cheerful personas that people put on, and that can make you feel awful if you're lonely. But I think social media has sort of become a bugbear that's, I'm probably using the wrong metaphor, but I think social media has become the natural go-to point for explaining why we feel more disconnected, when in fact the reasons run much deeper and they have things to do more with what Stephanie is talking about. But those things are hard to talk about, whereas Facebook is really easy to talk about.
Yes. And,
but I don't think Facebook is the problem. I think Facebook is subbing in for the loss of place, for the environmental degradation. You could just go on.
Okay, now, being obedient to the mood of the meeting, I am now going to steer us back where both of you are happier. Stephanie, I think given your interest in spirituality, you should launch Faithbook. Tell me...
launch what?
Faithbook.
A Faithbook.
And I want to ask you, does religious belief, does faith assuage, to use our word of the evening, assuage loneliness?
Look, not necessarily faith, not necessarily faith at all, but some sense of spiritual connection, undoubtedly. It doesn't mean that you're not going to feel alone sometimes, but you will feel alone differently. I can testify. I can testify to that, and not because of my own experience only, I might say, but because I've worked with literally hundreds and hundreds of people in workshops over these many, many years. And I've seen that there's sort of two factors to it. One is that a sense of spiritual seeking brings people together, generally speaking, with wholesome ideals, particularly when it's not entirely me focused, when it's also focused on, you know, and how can I contribute something to the society in which we live. And none of that depends on a kind of necessarily on a belief in a deity. But I think the other side of that is that most people who have a regular spiritual practice, you know, whether it's meditation, whether it's prayer, whether it's study, whether it's going to a community, whether it's chanting, whatever it is, not only will be doing some of those things with other people and sharing that experience, but also when you are actually doing those practices, they meet that place within yourself. And that's really what I meant when I said earlier that sometimes a tolerable amount or a small amount or a provocative amount of loneliness can be quite a useful catalyst, because it can say to you, what is it that I need to bring into my life? And also, and very significantly, what is it that I need to be giving to life in order to feel more connected?
Emily, I'm going to ask you a final question, and let me set it up. I believe that human beings are alone in the cosmos. I am an atheist. To me, the universe is meaningless. We create meanings that suit us. But at the same time, the ultimate loneliness comes from the fact that we are mortal and we know that we die. Mm-hmm. In the last couple of years, I've had some pretty close encounters with the Reaper, and I've been with a lot of people who have been dying. This is the loneliest time in the life of a human being. But once again, it's an important experience, I think, to feel or to face the approach of death alone as you ultimately are. Have you ever thought about this?
Yeah, and I don't agree with you. It's just a philosophical position that some people hold. I don't think we are fundamentally alone. You know, this notion that we're born alone, it's just actually not true. Your mom is there. And people are with us all the time, and we can have moments of aloneness, and we can savor that aloneness, but there's sort of a stoicism attached to the idea that we're born alone and we die alone, and a lot of people actually don't want to die alone either. I think we come into this world needing connection, and that doesn't need to be a romantic relationship, but I think a lot of what we're looking for in this world is connection. And you can find it in all sorts of ways. Stephanie's offered up faith. You can find connection through connecting to nature. You can find connection through throwing yourself into a cause.
Or you can find connections by being fortunate to have a radio program. And I've enjoyed our connections very much. And I thank the two of you. Unfortunately, Professor John Cacioppo left us. It wasn't his fault. Technology defeated us. He's the director of the Center for Cognitive and Social Neuroscience at the University of Chicago. And the author of something you might like to read, dear listener, Loneliness, Human Nature and the Need for Social Connection. Social commentator Dr. Stephanie Darick, author of oodles of books, but the one that's most relevant to this discussion, Intimacy and Solitude, and Emily White, author of Lonely, a Memoir. Thank you very much.
Thanks, bye.
Thank you, Philip. Thank you, Emily.
Now, beloved listeners, sticking with the topic of loneliness, I want to reintroduce the good professor who was so rudely cut off earlier in the program. Professor John Cacioppo is unarguably the world's leading expert on loneliness. He's director for the Center of Cognitive and Social Neuroscience at the University of Chicago, co-author of Loneliness, Human Nature and the Need for Social Connection. He's back with us in the comparative safety of a radio studio within his university. John, welcome back. At the beginning of the discussion, your working definition for loneliness is when, and I quote, there is a discrepancy between the desired social relations and those which actually occur. And you mentioned, for example, when a relationship with one's spouse falls short, leads to isolation and hence loneliness. So my question to you is, can one feel lonely in company?
One can feel especially lonely in company. One of the interesting features of the topic of loneliness is people tend to conflate it or confuse it with being alone. But if you just think of perhaps the loneliest time in your life, it might well be when you were sitting across the table from an estranged family member or spouse. To feel lonely is to feel socially isolated. And there's nothing more isolating than people standing around you who have rejected you and are ostracizing you.
Now, let us also dwell briefly on the difference between loneliness and solitude.
In fact, loneliness is the pain of being alone or feeling alone, and solitude is the pleasure of being alone and feeling alone. One of the interesting things we found in our research is people who are very low in loneliness, very high in connectedness, actually understand the importance of taking time for themselves, going off by themselves for that period of solitude.
John, something you say that flies in the face of theories by Richard Dawkins, an occasional guest on the program, who argues, of course, that our genes are guided purely by self-interest. You said recently that humans are inherently unselfish.
We have both sides. We can be compassionate and generous, and we can be selfish and exploitive. I differ from Richard Dawkins in not the selfish gene as a metaphor, but as a explicit description of humans and mammals generally. And the reason is simple. If you take Dawkins' notion, the gene who leads to perpetuating more genetic copies is the one whose behavior and structures are going to become more prevalent in our gene pool. If you look at most simple insects, that means the animal who's acting selfish. To the extent that it reproduces, then more gene copies will be available. With humans, mammals generally, mammals are defined by having offspring who require care and attention, otherwise they cannot survive on their own. So it's not so much your ability to reproduce as to have grandchildren that defines how likely are you to have a genetic legacy. And that changes the organism's behavior as well.
John, you argue that the pain of loneliness, like the ache of hunger or thirst, is a biological trigger. Hunger means you need to eat to survive. Pain sensors protect the individual from physical danger. What is loneliness trigger?
So triggers two things. Loneliness is very much like physical pain, in the sense that physical pain alerts you to something that you need to change, otherwise you'll incur tissue damage to your body. Loneliness is a signal that you need to pay attention to your social environment, to your social relationships, else you will lose that safe social surround that defines who we are as a social species. And so it triggers the motivation to search for and change your priorities so that you make sure you have those around you who you can support and who can support you, who provide mutual aid.
Later I want to discuss the danger, therefore, of suppressing the loneliness trigger. It could, in fact, be quite counterproductive, but we'll deal with that in due course. Are there common times when people feel most lonely? Adolescence, adulthood, at the approach of death. Gatsby, Jay Gatsby, for example, was lonelier as an adult, but I understand that it's clinically worse for adolescents and the elderly.
That's exactly right. There are situations that are associated with higher levels of loneliness. In terms of age, it's surprisingly flat across the lifespan. It does go up slightly with adolescence, and it goes up in very late life when one loses friends and family members and partners through just the devastation of age. And one becomes infirmed and less able to move around and find rewarding contacts.
I would have thought there's also a very high association between loneliness and suicide.
Suicide can have many different causes, but loneliness is definitely one of the major causes for suicide.
Okay. Is there a viable, cheap, realistic treatment for loneliness?
There have been a number of attempts to lower loneliness, and most of them have been based on intuitive understandings of loneliness. So an example of that is if people are lonely, just give them people with whom they can have interactions. And so you bring a bunch of lonely people together. It's called social engagement. That doesn't work very well. And the reason it doesn't work very well is loneliness is not really about being alone. It's about having others who you can trust and in whom you can confide. Another theory is that loneliness is just someone lacking social support. So if you provide support to others, then they will be less lonely. Well, all I need to do is to remind you that in a hospital, when you're a patient, you have lots of support. People come to running to your bedside with the press of a button, but it's a very isolating, lonely setting most of the time. So it's not about simply getting support. It's also about being able to provide that support. That's what makes social species unique, is the synergies that we achieve by working together. Go ahead.
No, please.
A third model of how to lower loneliness is to teach people social skills, that loneliness is simply the absence of social skills. And if you had those social skills, you too would be a popular kid. And what that doesn't understand is that popular people sometimes are among the loneliest. It isn't about not having others who would like to be with you. It's about not having others who you can trust. So you can imagine a billionaire who has a lot of people who would like to be a friend, but feels isolated because he knows or believes each of those individuals wants to be a friend only for their own material benefit. So it's really about being accepted authentically for who you are.
I had an odd friendship with a fellow called Kerry Packer, who was notoriously Australia's richest man, and he often said that to me, that he could not trust friendship because everyone wanted something from him, i.e. Crumbs from his table, his rich man's table, or perhaps by association some of his power. I talked to Stephanie and Emily about the lack of the ongoing absence of a loneliness pill, but you have something to say to us about opium.
Yes, in fact, opiates will squelch the pain of loneliness. Of course, it diminishes many of our other senses and feelings as well. What it does is it costs us our humanity. We stop caring about those around us. If you are a crack-addicted parent, you don't necessarily abuse a child, you neglect the child, because the cocaine or the crack is providing the rewards that usually come through our social interactions. And so in a funny kind of way, loneliness contributes to us being such a humane and compassionate species.
John, of course, we've made the point that if you were to have a simple medication, it would repress, as opium itself does, the signals, you know, the signals, the useful signals that loneliness triggers.
That is correct. And with pain as well, you can incur tissue damage but not feel it. That's what we do in surgeries, is we apply anesthesia so we can do disfiguring or harmful things to the body, and then we nurture that body so it heals again. If you simply cover up the symptoms of loneliness, then you lose that signal that helps us reunite when we are starting to lose those connections that are so powerful and valuable to us.
Have you found useful observations on loneliness from the sainted Sigmund Freud or Jung or any of the other front runners in matter psychiatric?
Yes and no. There are explicit observations about loneliness or the importance of sociality have not been helpful. What Freud and Jung did contribute, though, is a notion that much of what affects our behavior, and in fact our own mentation, what we think, what we feel, comes from non-conscious processes that the brain is performing in response to our history and in response to our genetic makeup and those around us. And loneliness is a very good case in point. Loneliness does a number of things of which we never have insight or awareness.
Some would argue, and I discussed this with Stephanie and Emily, some would argue that the new technologies, the so-called social media, are something of a miracle cure. I'm very skeptical about this. What's your view?
The research shows that clearly we are digitally more connected than we've ever been previously, but those connections are tools. It depends what you do with those tools. If you use those tools as your final destination, then you're sacrificing face-to-face relationships for those connected relationships, and particularly when those connected relationships are non-authentic. I might present myself as being somebody I'm not because that's more likely to be accepted by others with whom I'm interacting online, then it actually can make loneliness worse. It feels better at the moment, but in the long term, it makes it worse, a little bit like eating lettuce or celery when you're hungry. It's not actually nutritious.
So the idea that a website could deliver a friendlier, interconnected world is bogus. The depth of one's social network outside Facebook is what determines the depth of one's social network within Facebook.
That's right. So one can use social networking sites to, in fact, enhance that actual life face-to-face interacting with individuals. I can remain in contact with friends that I now live quite distant from, keep up to date with them, and then when I go back and visit, we pick up that friendship where we left off. Otherwise, I would have lost it. And so it's a tool that can be used.
Going back to the realms of the analyst and the psychologist, I understand that you're developing a therapy for chronic loneliness.
We've been working with the U.S. Army to try to build social resilience in their troops. The life in any military is inherently very isolating. You take people away from friends and families. You put them in foreign lands that are hostile. You lose compatriots in battle. I mean, it's a very isolating, difficult experience. And so we have been working with the soldiers in these different platoons in the Army to try to build resilience so that when they incur those kinds of exclusionary experiences, they're better prepared to handle them.
We've done a great many programs over the years, and quite a few in the last few weeks, actually, on PTSD. I would imagine for an ex-soldier, that's the ultimate form of loneliness.
We've talked to many soldiers and vets at this point, and one of the things that they tell us is it's really difficult going back home after you've been in war, that it's just an experience that you can't share with most people. They don't understand, and some of it looks inappropriate when, in fact, it's the best one can do. And so they need to talk to other veterans who are able to relate to the same experiences and try to have that opportunity to find solace in the situation that they had to endure.
John, what about loneliness at the end of life?
Really depends on one's circumstance. Where we have found loneliness rises at the end of life is when one no longer has meaningful pursuits. They lose significant others. They perhaps have retired and no longer feel like their life has meaning. And those are the individuals who are most likely to fall into chronic loneliness. It isn't a necessary consequence of aging, though. If you continue to connect with other individuals, especially younger individuals, if you're giving back something to future generations and living a meaningful life, then that really can fill one's life with meaningful connections for the duration of one's lifespan.
I share one set of convictions with Richard Dawkins, and that is we're both rather loud atheists. But I have to ask you this. Does having faith assuage loneliness?
One of the things that we did find was that if I experimentally make you feel lonelier, your belief in God goes up. But it's also the case that if I experimentally make you feel lonelier, you're also more likely to anthropomorphize celestial bodies, technical devices, and pets. So there, if you're not able to connect literally, then you connect inferentially through anthropomorphism.
You've just mentioned in passing pets. My observation is that they're an immense help to those of us who spend a lot of time alone.
Interestingly, we've looked at that in a population-based longitudinal study, and we find certain pets, certain kinds of pets, fish, reptiles, don't actually lower loneliness. Don't raise it, just doesn't lower it. Dogs seem to be the most effective in lowering loneliness. That is, people who owned dogs were less lonely. Now, in fact, we didn't look longitudinally at that particular relationship, so it may be that less lonely people are more likely to buy dogs. But it may be, my guess is that it's causal, and it's because if you have a dog, you have to take the dog and walk it. And if you're walking your dog, you meet neighbors. And if you meet them, you start to talk to them, and you start to get to know people in the vicinity.
John, a pleasure and a privilege. Thanks for coming back, and please forgive us for the technical failures we had to endure earlier. My guest has been Professor John Cacioppo, Director for Cognitive and Social Neuroscience at the University of Chicago. Now, that's your lot for now, dear listener. But next on the show, Andrew Knight, that fine TV producer, writer, and brains behind, amongst many things, Sea Change. So, Andrew Knight on Late Night Live on Radio National.
The Prime Minister departs today on Australia's biggest ever trade mission to North Asia.
And before the end of the year, expects to sign a free trade deal with Australia's biggest trading partner, China. Free trade deals are all rage, but what have been the benefits to Australia?
We are disappointed that we couldn't get sugar into this deal.
That's Rear Vision, China, Australia and free trade agreements. Download or stream this Rear Vision from the RN website.